This is Works in Progress, a podcast of the UCLA School of the Arts and Architecture. I'm Avishai Artsy. 2020 has been a year of challenge and change. COVID-19, economic insecurity, the calls for racial and social justice, the presidential election, and political polarization. Our nation's wounds have been laid bare. The road to healing is a long one. So how do we now come together? How do we sit down and talk to each other and really listen? How do we do this with people whose values and beliefs are diametrically opposed to our own? Is this even possible?
If people communicate and we look at each other and see each other and value each other, it's not easy, but it's worthwhile, and it can lead to creating solutions that didn't exist before.
Anna Spain Bradley is an expert in international law, and she's advised the United Nations on global racism and human rights. In September, she became UCLA's new Vice Chancellor for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion. In her new role, she's leading a team to create a more inclusive learning environment. She'll also be a panelist for the final session in this year's 10 Questions Reckoning discussion series, responding to the question, what matters? I asked her how she approaches that question.
I think there are many ways to ask the question in addition to answering it. And, you know, we might start with what matters to you based on where you live, who you are, the stage of life you find yourself in, what matters to us, the family, the community, the nation, the world. What matters now as we are living in and going through major global shifts, even as our daily life might at times feel like it's at a standstill? So I'll begin the answer situated in that last framing, which is what matters now. And I believe that the answer is something very close to each of us. We do. We, the people, matter now. More specifically, how we define ourselves, our sense of identity, belonging with dignity, and our pursuit of a common humanity. These are the things that matter now. And it's because we together will have to survive the pandemic. We'll have to continue these long fights for justice that we face in America and around the world. We have to rise to the challenge that's going to be required of all of us to mitigate the impacts of climate change and now and in the future. And to do those things and more, we have to be rooted in a commitment to and a pursuit of a common humanity. So what does humanity mean? Why is it important? What does it stand for? And that's where I would say, framing the question that way, I would ask, what matters? Why does humanity matter? And why does humanity matter now?
I'm interested in the word dignity, which you used, and I've seen you use that before. On September 1st, when you began your new role at UCLA, you tweeted that you are, quote, ready to work hard to help our community move through these challenging times with dignity together. So what does it mean to you to move together with dignity?
So dignity is a cornerstone framing for me as somebody who comes into the world, having experienced a lot of different forms of discrimination in my life, and as somebody who has been trained as a lawyer, a human rights advocate at the United Nations, and as a law professor, educator, and scholar. And dignity is this principle that we all have inherent value because we are human. And it is that principle that the framework for our international universal human rights system was built around. And dignity means that, you know, wherever we are, we don't adhere to the idea that people are inherently superior or inferior. We all have value, even if our value is different, and we have to appreciate each other's value. The other thing about dignity that people don't often talk about is the dark side. What happens to a person when she, he, or they are denied their dignity? And if you go to stories of loss, if you go to stories of hardship, if you go to stories of oppression, you hear in them this moment where someone has lost their dignity because someone else has taken it from them. And it's that which kind of can deep inside of ourselves be something that we hold on to that's painful. And for some people, it's what causes us to respond in ways that cause conflict or violence or more. So dignity is not just important as a lofty goal or aspirational value. It's really a building block for peace and for a peaceful world. And it's the thing that we can all do in our lives to make the world a better place.
When you look around the world now, does it surprise you at the levels in which people deny others their dignity? It seems like we're at an incredibly contentious time in our body politic, and there is that level of denying others dignity and humanity that we see.
I mean, it's such an interesting and important and rich question, and I'll just cut one slice at it, which is to say I'm not surprised at all. I think if we look at human behavior, we know that most of us are social creatures in some form or fashion. We certainly respond to each other. And when there's overwhelming joy and happiness and light, other people respond in kind. And when there's overwhelming, meanness and cruelness, sometimes people respond in kind. And so, you know, we get to this idea that what does it take to move through the world in a way because you choose to, as opposed to being reactive to how someone else is treating you, especially when it's bad. But I do think, you know, we have to take stock of some of the important knowledge and statistics out there, that the world by far is still at one of its most peaceful times if you measure peace as the absence of war, which isn't the only way to measure peace, and it's not necessarily the right way. But the absence of war, we've had a steep decline in war between nations since the end of World War II. We still have armed conflicts in the world that still cause harm, but overall, the recourse to war is down. At the same time, people in our daily lives do feel like things are getting tense and people are not treating each other with not even kindness, but just like basic respect. And I think we have to ask why. There's been important research showing, you know, this move to virtual life because we can't be in person because of the pandemic causes people to treat each other less with less empathy because we're not across the room. We can't look at each other in the eye. We can't read each other's body language. And it's easier perhaps for some people to be cruel when you have a computer screen separating you from the other person. So I think as we reach a 2021 world where we're still going to be remote, at least for a while, we have to have a renewed commitment to increasing our awareness of that we want to be dignified, treat each other with dignity, and that is a common value that we all strive to uphold.
What you're talking about is something that's sort of rooted in our culture and in the way we treat each other, yet your background is in law. Do you see limitations in what the law can achieve, what policies can achieve, when we're talking about something as simple as how one human being treats another?
Yeah, so it's another rich question, and because what is law? And this is something that legal theorists and scholars spend a lot of time looking at. And, you know, I subscribe to the idea that whatever else law is, it is also somehow human. And I riff there from Ralph Ellison's wonderful phrasing in The Invisible Man. But I have a book coming out. It's called Human Choice in International Law. It's out on Cambridge University Press this spring. And it's making the case that law is not something that just appears written down as a rule that embeds a norm with consequences. Law is something that comes out of human heads and hearts, and our very own ways of thinking, memories, emotions are connected to what we envision the law and the rules to be, and how we set up structures and systems to uphold and enforce them. And we can see that really powerfully in the United States today when we look at decisions that perhaps the Supreme Court are taking, or the way that Congress is pushing through new regulations and legislation. And we say, you know, is it possible to have laws that don't uphold the constitutional values? Is it possible to have laws that are indeed harmful? And the answer throughout history is yes. We've seen many times where something that was legal, like slavery, completely legal for a very long time, was morally and ethically reprehensible. And so how does this happen? Well, it happens because humans make the law. And I'm going to try to quote a phrase from the book Cry My Beloved Country that I might misquote, but it goes something like, the judge does not make the law. The people make the law. Therefore, if the judge judges according to the law, that is justice, even if it's not just. And I think it gets to the point of there's a difference between law and justice, and there's difference between justice and what's just. And it's in all those spaces that we have to search for dignity and search for what's the best about us as humanity, and uphold those values.
That's so interesting. Talking about justice versus the law and when they're not the same. To what degree do you think people in America right now are acutely aware of the shortcomings of the justice system and of the legal system, and are recognizing and calling for kind of a refashioning of law in a way that does account for implicit bias and account for the shortcomings in humanity in order to make the law more accountable?
I think people today are very well aware of the major weaknesses and fractures in our American democracy, which is the oldest democracy of a nation, sovereign nation in the world, and are well aware that the things we thought were undeniably strong have shown to be less so in the last 4 years. And so here we have to say, it's not just about a law that sets up a legal system or a government that's set up by a constitution. It's about the people, the sources of legitimacy, the sources of authority. And here, rulers have certain authority, and often the major form of authority comes from the policing power. If you control the police or you control the military, you control a lot. But people also have incredible power. And it's our voices together as a collective that can force and push forward important change. And that's exactly what we've seen in America, in a way that's very powerful, that some would say that we haven't seen since the days of my dad and his generation of the civil rights movement, which is in the last spring and summer, people demonstrated, raised their voices, and called for change. And institutions are starting to respond. Now, the response could go further, it could go deeper, it could do better, but we have seen response across private and public sector, all kinds of organizations standing up language that Black Lives Matter, standing up language about how to reduce or prevent racism. But what we have also tied that back to is the fact that those changes don't just come because it's, quote, the right thing to do. They come because of the power and the force, if you will, of people in mass calling for change. And that kind of legitimacy, is one of the most important pieces of our democracy.
You are a professional mediator. You have over 20 years of experience specializing in workplace disputes and identity-based conflict. As I've said, we're just coming out of this incredibly acrimonious presidential election. The country is sharply divided. If you were on the Biden-Harris transition team, what advice would you give to bring these sides together?
That's a big one. And bless the people who are on the transition team and who are graciously serving the country in that way. So I used to work in government. I was a lawyer at the State Department, an attorney advisor a long time ago. And even before that, I worked on climate change and trade at EPA and USTR. So I have a deep appreciation for the civil service and for all those who serve in government roles. What I would say here is what has been a critique of the Trump administration, certainly, but even going back to Obama and other presidents. And it goes to the core of the tension. It is true that change has to happen most of the time with the people, whoever you define the people to be, that you want to encourage dialogue. You want to be able to hear people's positions and separate them down into the underlying interests and needs. That you want to be able to negotiate the differences and come out the other side with some kind of an agreement. The difference is that that kind of platform, which is very common in mediation and negotiation and all of those spaces, doesn't deal well with the other challenge that we see in racism and other forms of discrimination, which is where one person or group truly believes that they are superior in their identity and in their existence to another group, on the basis of whether it's race, gender, sexual orientation, et cetera. And mediation, dialogue, et cetera, is not set up to deal with, it's not traditionally set up to deal with these kinds of tensions over people's very identity. And there we have to take a more nuanced and careful approach. So the question is, if I'm sitting across the table from someone else who identifies as a different race than me, and identifies as a different gender, I identify as a woman, they identify as a man, and they truly believe they're superior to me, that's not the conditions in which you can have an effective dialogue. And so a transition team,
a new government, whoever it is, needs to try to bring America together, but with certain ground rules. And that goes back to the ground rule of dignity. Dignity means we all inherently have value, and there's no space for, you know, racial superiority or other forms of superiority or supremacy in the beginning of a dialogue. So if you can't agree to the core principle of dignity, it's going to be dangerous to try to treat those stakeholders and voices as being part of the conversation in the same way everywhere else. Now, what we can afford for is important conversations across difference on policy, on difference of perspective or priorities. Those things matter. And we in America should endeavor to embrace conversations around that. But again, you don't want to set up a wonderful, everyone is invited conversation where you actually allow for oppression of certain people therein.
Do you think that advice holds when you're sitting at a dinner table across from a family member who might hold radically different views from you? Is that the same avenue that you'd suggest people take to have that kind of conversation and move forward constructively when it's somebody that, you know, you're very close to? It's not about policy. It's not about law. It's just about your relationship.
I think it's all depends on the details. You know, is this a family member? What's the relationship? Do people have the option to walk away? What's the power dynamic? You know, if it's a parent child, that's very different from two grown-ups who have relatively equal power in the conversation. Are there ground rules? Can you have a conversation about things that are emotionally hard and still respect each other and treat each other with dignity? Or does the conversation delve into something more dangerous and something that actually has more harm than good? So all of those, I think, are very nuanced things that you can't give one size fits all answer to. But I keep going back to this idea that if we value each other, then that's a different conversation than people who have to be convinced that other people have value.
You have recently stepped into this new role at UCLA as the Vice Chancellor for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion. This is such a tumultuous time to be working on EDI issues. So what are the challenges and opportunities that you see in the road ahead at UCLA?
It's a great question. And you know, here I'm shifting kind of out of my own personal view to talk more about my role as a leader and administrator at UCLA. And so in that regard, just first of all, I have to say thank you to my predecessor, Jerry Kong. He is a professor of law and has such a rich background in a lot of different areas, including implicit bias, which was very important to the shaping of the office. And he had a tough job. He had to stand up an office that didn't previously exist. I would say that in 2021 and beyond, we're looking at some different conditions on campus. I am very interested in prioritizing our office's relationship with our students, learning from them, listening to them, and encouraging them to become a part of solution creation around some of the core challenges. I'm also very interested in, you know, especially in a post-COVID-19 world where we can move around and see people, getting out into the community in Los Angeles and Southern California and working with our community partners, learning from them and sharing some of our resources. We have a speaker series coming up this 2021 that we're standing up, where we'll be inviting some of those wonderful leaders and experts in our local community to come and share their knowledge and wisdom with us at UCLA. Back to the mission, what people don't really know about the Office of Equity, Diversity, Inclusion at UCLA is that we're kind of unique among EDI offices on university campuses, because we do EDI work, lots of research and data, but we also hold what's going to be newly branded as the Civil Rights Office, and that is all of our investigatory units that comply with federal and state law and our own policy to prevent discrimination and harassment. So we have both of these under one office, and it leads for rich engagement about prevention versus compliance and accountability that we're engaging.
In terms of challenges, you did say that 2021 would be very different than the last few years. One is that learning is now, at least for the time being done remotely. And I wonder if that poses a challenge. You know, maybe students have less access to technology or other resources that they might otherwise be able to find on campus. So how does remote learning create new problems or opportunities in regards to EDI?
Yeah. So, I mean, here I have to defer to the students to share their own experiences, but what they've shared directly with me, and we have this wonderful group called our Student Advisory Board that I met with last week, students throughout our campus who serve in this role. But in short, you know, not every student has a quiet space to take an exam at a particular time. Not every student has access to steady Wi-Fi that you can count on at a particular time. And so students just on a purely academic standpoint need a lot more flexibility in their classroom assignments and the ability to take exams, et cetera. And we're heading into exam mode soon. So I know students, that's first and foremost on their mind. I think beyond that, the students are facing the challenges that we're all facing, which is how do you stay healthy? How do you have good mental health when you're quarantined, when you can't see people, when you can't get out in the world or move around as much? It's a real challenge, and it taps into our need for individual and community resilience more than we've ever had to stand up, most of us in our lives. So I think this goes to say that now is a time for adaptability and for understanding, for maximum flexibility. You know, we want to encourage a good education, and what that looked like in 2018 might be very different from what it looks like now and what it will look like in 2 years. So, you know, this is to say one size doesn't fit all. And so we want to make sure that we have an eye towards treating people as full people and not just as students who have to complete an assignment on time.
So you are a scholar of international law, and as we've discussed already, you specialize in international dispute resolution, peace and security, and human rights. You have a long list of accomplishments. I'll just name a couple. So you represented the U.S. before the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal in The Hague. You were a delegate to the UN Compensation Commission in Geneva. You've worked at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency on climate change issues and at the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative on international trade agreements. So those are all big roles on an international stage. What insights have you gained on the human condition through this work and these experiences, and how might those experiences inform your work at UCLA?
That's a beautiful question, and I really appreciate it. And so I want to answer it by telling a short story, which is very early in my career at the State Department, when I was, for some reason, set off to be the U.S. delegate at the United Nations. So I was a delegate for the United States, representing the United States in a UN body that was going to have to decide on important issues dealing with compensation for victims after Iraq's illegal invasion into Kuwait. And all this is to say, it took place in Geneva, lovely Geneva, on the lake, Lake Geneva. And in the United Nations building there's something called the Serpentine Lounge because of its shape. And coffee and tea is served, and it has very 1970s-esque tables and chairs. It feels like something out of a movie. And I remember as a young person walking into that room, and I literally saw faces from all over the world, every single possible way of being. And it was my first exposure to that kind of global diversity. And then I saw the smiles, the tea being shared, the conversations. And to answer your question, that taught me an important lesson, that people who come from all walks of life, but come together around some sort of shared value or shared project or mission, can solve any problem. And there's always hope in that. And so, you know, United Nations gets critiqued left and right. It's a big place. There's a lot of improvements to be made, but it's the best we've got as a world for global cooperation. And it's a beautiful thing to see global cooperation happen in action. That should give us all hope.
Well, getting back to UCLA, so I had asked you about lessons learned from your work on the international stage. UCLA itself is famously decentralized. You have multiple colleges working largely autonomously. UCLA itself is kind of a city-state within Los Angeles. Do you see UCLA as a microcosm for the U.S. and the world in terms of the challenges we face?
Well, it's too soon for me to opine on that, but I would say that, you know, UCLA, nothing prepared me for UCLA like the State Department, which is also extremely bureaucratic. And the great thing about UCLA, something that I was thrilled about and really excited to join our community here, is the fact that we are diverse in global ways, that people come from all over the place, from all kinds of backgrounds. And it allows us, that kind of diversity allows us to have richer, deeper engagement about what does inclusion feel like? Why are people excluded? How do we get to what we all want, which is a place to feel like we're home? You know, we belong, we're seen, we're accepted. So to be able to have the privilege of doing EDI work at a place like UCLA is really an honor, because you can reach lots of deeper, complex questions. And I think back to your earlier question about, you know, one of my priorities and platforms as vice chancellor going forward is to set up spaces for people to explore these richer connections, to explore areas of difference, areas of power and hierarchy, and ultimately, how is it that people choose to identify in our very 21st century world? What do those identities do for us, and how do they help and harm us? And it's part of this broader project that I'm involved in on global racism. I'm writing a book on that topic and envisioning and understanding what race is around the world and what racism looks like around the world, and the human rights frameworks that have or need to reach that question. And I'm also a part of the UN group. It's called the Ad Hoc Subcommittee that looks at ways to better implement the treaty that banned racial discrimination. And so it's very important to me, these questions of human identity and belonging. And UCLA is a wonderful place for people to engage around those questions. So I think you're right. It's a complex environment. And I've learned you have to talk to at least 5 people before you can get anything done. But it's in having those wonderful conversations that you see the real possibility that people coming together, putting our heads together and our hearts together around important challenges, there's nothing we can't do.
You come to this role at UCLA from a similar role at University of Colorado at Boulder, where you were the Assistant Vice Provost for Faculty Development and Diversity. I think I have that right.
Yes.
So are the challenges that UCLA faces the same that all institutions of higher education across the nation face? Or are there some distinctions that you see between universities and campus climates?
So both and. I think on a basic level, whether it's a university, a workplace, an organization, or government, anytime you get large groups of people together, there's going to be some common challenges. People tend to want some kind of hierarchy to say, you know, so-and-so is in charge and gives orders and other people do X, Y, and Z, or they have a hierarchy based on, you know, so-called meritocracy or so-called experience, you know, all these sort of things that we set up hierarchies. In other words, you don't find in most workplaces or universities egalitarian structures. Now, some places you do find that is if you have a student group who've come together and said, we're just going to join together around a topic together, or a faculty group where everyone is at the same sort of level and saying, you know, we are all faculty teaching in a certain area. But even in egalitarian structures, there's still this push and desire for who's more important, who has more value. And anytime you create that, you have people who are deemed to have less importance and less value. And that's where the challenges are around EDI. Now, the things about UCLA that are unique, I just mentioned one, which is our incredible, rich, global diversity, where people come literally from all kinds of places and identities to this one campus to engage in learning and research, and it's wonderful. The other thing that makes UCLA unique, and it's within the UC system, is this structure that it has that shares governance between the chancellor and the executive vice chancellor and provost and the administrative leadership and the faculty. And so that's an interesting structure that not all universities have. And it affords, you know, faculty with certain rights and responsibilities for governance that a lot of other universities don't have. So I think there are things about UCLA that make it pretty unique. Of course, UCLA also has a history of important protests going back to its origins and its founding and standing up for the rights of vulnerable communities. And that matters very much to the question of what is UCLA.
This is not your first time working at UCLA. You were, prior to being at UC Boulder, you were the deputy director of the UCLA Burkle Center for International Relations and a lecturer at UCLA Law School. Will you be teaching at UCLA again?
So in my current role, I am full-time in administrative leadership. So I will not be afforded the opportunity to teach a quarter-long course in the near future. But teaching and education is a part of, you know, my professional identity. I care about it. I'm very proud to have won a big national award for teaching. It was the Aussie Educator Award. I believe that education is a interactive enterprise. And in my classrooms, I created subcultures where we all learned from each other. Information flowed up, down, sideways, diagonal. And that was very important to me. So I think what I would say about that story is it's also important to recognize another group at UCLA who are staff. When I worked at UCLA before, I was staff. I was deputy director, and I had come out of the State Department as a lawyer, was making a career transition, and was getting ready to become an academic. And I went on the academic law professor job market and was hired at University of Colorado Boulder as a tenure track professor, and then moved through the various ranks of reappointment, tenure, and ultimately full professor before coming back to UCLA in this role of faculty and administrative leadership. And so I understand those perspectives that staff often talk about, which is they don't feel as valued as faculty or students. They often feel that, you know, platforms and policies and programs don't reach or reach them as an afterthought. And I think it's important as part of the EDI mission to understand that people are more than our various categories. We are more than students, staff, and faculty. We are also come together around different identities. And it's time to help people understand that, even as we respect our different and distinct roles.
Can I ask you a little bit about how you ended up getting into the field of international law? Like, was there something in your upbringing or in your family history that made you decide that you wanted to work in international law?
Yes. So everybody who comes into international law, much like mediation, has a backstory. We all do. So I am the child of my dad, who is a Black man from the rural South, who grew up, you know, before desegregation, and my mom, who is white and British and from the very north of England, the area of Newcastle. They met in a fabulous love story when they were in the Peace Corps, in the British version of that, in Malawi. They got married before Loving versus Virginia. And, you know, my sister and I grew up in the United States, mostly a little bit in England, but I have family all over the world. I have a cousin-in-law who survived the war in Sierra Leone. I have cousins in Gibraltar, whose dad is Portuguese. I have people in my family from, you know, North Carolina and not far from the place that was formerly the plantation where my ancestors were enslaved. And so, you know, all these people who are in my family early on helped me see that there was a world out there. And I was very eager to go places, to travel, to see people and be among people from high school. And I also just had this interest in the United Nations and international spaces before I even knew what they were. So when I had the opportunity to go to Harvard Law School, I knew from day one that I wanted to pursue international law and human rights. And it was a fantastic place to do that. And I also was able to meet people who are not only human rights advocates from the United States, but from all over the world, who really enriched my experiences.
You mentioned that you're writing a book about global racism. When we think about racism in the U.S., generally we think about the enslavement of Africans and they're being brought to the U.S. to work, like you mentioned, on plantations in the South, and then the laws that grew to perpetuate policies that, you know, continue to oppress African Americans. I wonder, in studying global racism, does that somehow deepen or change your understanding of the nature of racism when you look at examples that come from outside the U.S.?
Absolutely. And this is part of the project. So I wrote in 2019 a piece in the Harvard Human Rights Journal called Human Rights Racism. And what it did was identify, I believe for the first time, that there was a big gap in international law and there's a big gap in human rights law. And that is that all the treaties we have in the world today, and a treaty, again, is a international law that's binding upon nations if when they've signed it and ratified it. And all those treaties, they only use the words race or racial discrimination. None of them say racism. And so I was curious about that, and I went looking. And in that looking, I also, today, if we ask people who have been victimized, they often use the word racism. And so that led me on this whole big project, which is to say that around the world, people experience exclusion, loss of job opportunities, not being able to live certain places, harm to their life and limb, and violation of their human dignity because they are identified by a government or by others as being of a certain race and or ethnicity. And when we try to reach, well, what is the difference between race and ethnicity? What's the difference between race, ethnicity, and religion? Nobody agrees on what racism is from a global perspective. So that's the nature of my project, is investigating and tying together the threads. Because if we can have a common global understanding, not only of what racism is in a real lived way, but of the full nature of its harms, then we're going to be much better prepared to stand up measures to combat and prevent racism.
What does it mean for you personally, as a Black woman and a person of color, to be in this world and in this role at this time?
I feel both lucky and, what's the right word, obliged. Lucky because, you know, I won't tell my full story here, but if you looked at where I lived and who I was around and what my options were at the age of 14 or 15, and you've seen how far I've come, a story like that is a story that's only made possible by having certain freedoms and opportunities that we have in America. Now, there are other countries you have those too, but it's not true everywhere. That as a woman, that as a Black woman, without, you know, family who were rich or family who were well-placed, I was able to, through various mechanisms, through great mentors, through education, make my way forward in this world. I feel obliged because of Annie Kay. She was my great-grandmother, who I'm named after. She, at the age of 16, ran away from this town so small in Georgia that doesn't exist anymore to get away from an extremely bleak life. Took the railroad to where it stopped in Sebring, Florida, and started a new life. And when I look at what she went through, and I look at what my grandmother went through, and I look at other people who are close to me, they did so much and carried so many things so that I could be here. And I have an obligation to them and to all the people who don't have the opportunity that I have now to lead this space forward and make a difference for some people where I can. So it's one part feeling amazing and honored to be in this role at a wonderful place like UCLA, but it's another part of feeling truly like, but of course I can because they did. And I definitely feel that obligation to pay it forward, especially for my two daughters who, you know, hopefully will make their way forward, you know, because of some of the things that I was able to do for them.
That was Anna Spain Bradley, UCLA's Vice Chancellor for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion. You can hear her speak at the final UCLA 10 Questions Reckoning session of the year on Monday, December 7th, responding to the question, What Matters? Alongside opera, film, theater, and festival director Peter Sellers and theater writer and medieval and early modern historian Theo Ruiz. And this is the final episode of Season 2 of Works in Progress. Thank you for listening. If you like this podcast, please rate, review, subscribe, and share it with friends. We'll be back in 2021 with more conversations from the UCLA School of the Arts and Architecture. Until then, be well and take care.